period when everyone's going from late classes to the cafeteria for dinner. In the confusion of people running around, no one will miss us. And hopefully, they won't be able to hear us either.
Anything?
Jai asks, clutching his violin. I push aside some leaves to peek at Darby, who sits on the front steps of Harmony Hall, like she's waiting for a friend. Totally casual. Nothing suspicious here, no sir. The idea is to get Mrs. LaRue out of her office so Darby can run in and grab Wink, which means we have to create a big enough distraction outside that the headmaestro is forced to deal with it herself. I shake my head and zip up my jacket. It's been getting colder every day, and the dropping temperatures are just a reminder that my test is getting closer. Only a month until my fate is decided once and for all.
What's she waiting for? Jai growls. We've been sitting here for hours.
More like 10 minutes, I point out. But my nerves are on edge, about to snap. The longer we wait, the closer I get to chickening out altogether. Settling back on my heels, I polish a spot on my flute with the hem of my skirt. The bush we're in is big enough that we could be standing upright if we wanted, but we're trying to keep the rustling branches to a minimum. Being discovered in a bush with Jai Kapoor isn't exactly the sort of distraction I want to cause, and there's no good way to explain ourselves if we were caught. I think we'd both just die of humiliation on the spot. Sighing, I watch Jai methodically rub rosin over his bow. You know, I say, one day we'll be high schoolers too, and Rebel Clef will need new members. Jai glances at me sidelong. Really having trouble picturing you shredding a guitar, Jones. I'm not talking about me, dummy. You. He presses his lips together and plucks the E string on his violin. I told you, my dad would never— Oh, come on! I saw you checking out Rebel Clef's guitars. I know that's what you listen to when you pretend it's just Bach and Beethoven in your ears. Are you really going to let your dad stop you?
You don't understand,
he mumbles. My gran hates music craft, I say. She did everything she could to stop me from coming here. But here I am. I spread my hands. All I'm saying is, one day you're going to have to tell him how you really feel. Release the inner rock star. I wave my hand in the air, my index finger, pinky, and thumb spread wide. Jai cocks an eyebrow.
What is that?
I waggle my hand. You know, the rocker symbol.
That's sign language for I love you. You gotta put the thumb down.
I snatch my hand out of the air, face suddenly hot. Oh. He rolls his eyes.
Look, maybe your dad's all touchy-feely, but mine's about as huggable as a homicidal porcupine.
I drop my gaze, my stomach shriveling into a hard knot. I wouldn't know. Haven't seen mine since my mom died. I don't even remember what he looks like. It's mostly true. I can remember his voice, his laugh, and even what his footsteps sounded like when he came through the front door. But his face is a blur in my memory.
Do you know his name?
I hesitate, then say in a tight voice, Eric. Eric Neal. Jai's eyes widen.
Well, did he go to Mistwick?
For a while, but he dropped out. That seems to be his thing, dropping out. Out of school, out of responsibility, out of my life.
Then he must be in the records,
Jai says.
Or maybe in a yearbook? We could look and
know. He gives me a startled look, and I realize I sounded harsher than I'd intended. I don't care, okay? I say. Look, if he wanted to be around, he would be. But I'm not going to waste time finding someone who doesn't want to be found. I don't care if I never meet him, and that's the truth. Jai nods and doesn't say anything else about it, for which I'm grateful. My face is burning as it is, and like always when I think about my dad, anger ignites in my chest until it feels like I can't even breathe. To distract myself, I look up at Darby. She's standing up, furiously tapping her nose, like she's been doing it a while. The signal, oops.
Go, Jai,
I hiss. And then I stand and raise my flute, beginning to play Row, Row, Row Your Boat. It's the most basic of hovering spells, so it isn't very strong.
Usually, it can lift something an inch or two. Jai joins in, his back against mine in the small space, branches poking us from every side. There's barely enough room for him to move his bow, but he makes it work. The melody is light and quick, and Jai and I play overlapping one another, a continuous stream of notes pouring away in pale yellow wisps. I focus hard on the water, glinting just steps away. We're far enough from the buildings that no one should hear us. But the hum frogs do. And the result is so instantaneous, I almost swallow my tongue. Dozens, no, hundreds of frogs rise out of the lake, looking startled. From the water, the banks, even the bushes around me, the little creatures lift off and float through the air, webbed feet kicking like they're trying to swim. The sound of surprised croaking breaks out, loud enough that some of the students shout out, pointing toward the lake. Jai and I exchange looks. He's grinning ear to ear. I can't smile back without breaking off playing, so I raise my eyebrows instead. This is going perfectly. Hopefully, the sight of a couple hundred floating frogs will be enough to lure Mrs. LaRue from her office. Everything is going according to plan. Then, of course, the plan goes haywire. See, no one told us that hum frogs, like echo trees, can repeat melodies they hear. And that, like music cats, they're one of the few animal species with the peculiar ability to create magic with their voices. Because that's what they begin to do now. All across the lake, the flying amphibians' croaking starts to blend together in a scratchy, noisy, froggy symphony. And hearing a couple hundred frogs hum "Row, row, row your boat" in unison is easily one of the most terrifying things I have ever heard. Worse, while the spell may be weak when just a few people play it, as the fourth rule of music craft promises, the more individuals who join in, the stronger it gets. The result here is like Jai and I tried to light a campfire and caused a wildfire instead. Frogs go everywhere. I soon realize I don't have to keep playing because the frogs are drowning me out anyway. They don't even sound like normal frogs. Their voices are deep but agile, almost human. It sounds like they're really singing "row, row, row." And the more they sing the hovering spell, the higher and higher they float. And the more they spread out, like a cloud unrolling across the school. I jump out of the bush, horrified. There's nothing I can do to stop it. Swarms of frogs float through the air. Now everyone up the hill can see what's going on, and students start wandering down to take a closer look. They're so focused on the floating frog choir that they don't notice Jai and me tumbling out of the bushes, pulling our instruments with us. Jai, what do we do? He turns to me, eyes wide. Do we finish the spell? I ask. It's not our spell to finish anymore. He waves a hand at the clouds of frogs thickening the air. I can barely even hear him for the thunderous croaking. I see what he means. Row your boat is a perpetual canon, meaning its magic can go on and on and on until the musicians playing it decide to stop. One of my favorite stories when I was little was about how the orchestra on the Titanic played it nonstop for days after the ship hit an iceberg, floating the entire thing safely to land. But unlike me, Jai, and the Titanic's orchestra, frogs have no way of deciding when to end the spell. They'll probably keep croaking it until they all, well, croak. Did you know this would happen? This part of the plan had been Darby's idea. Actually, the entire plan had been Darby's idea. Of course not. His eyes grow wide. Amelia, watch out! A frog, spinning a bit wildly through the air, smacks me in the face. I yelp and duck as more of them go soaring overhead. In their alarm at finding themselves suddenly airborne, the frogs seem to have sped up the tempo of the spell, singing at an increasingly frenzied pace. This, I realize, only serves to make them fly faster, and their frantic flopping sends them into crazy spins. We could try to transpose the key, he says. Reverse the spell. We raise our instruments and try it, sloppily. Jai gets it right before I do.
But soon, so many frogs are smacking into us that we're forced to lower our instruments and cover our faces, our pitiful attempt quickly drowned out by the roar of croaks. Turns out, it's impossible to play any kind of music when you're being pelted by panicked flying frogs. I even try singing the notes in minor key, hoping the frogs will repeat that instead. But all I get is a slimy, wet frog smacked on my mouth. Spitting and gagging in disgust, I wrap myself around my flute to protect it and give up. Jai, we have to get inside. He just shakes his head at me, and I realize he can't hear me. Then I feel a strange sensation, like someone is pulling at my legs. My whole body starts to feel lighter and lighter, because I'm lifting off the ground. With a scream, I grab hold of the bush, anchoring myself to the earth as the frog's spell starts to take hold of me. Beside me, Jai is doing the same thing, and this time I can hear him yelling even over the croaking frogs. "Don't let go!" I shout. But I hardly need to tell him. He's clinging to the bush like, well, like he's a balloon, and it's the only thing holding him down. My legs are now pointed to the sky. Completely upside down, I have a weird view of the lake, where I see more things popping from the water. Fish and turtles are starting to fly too. The frog's spell is so strong, it's even reaching the bottom of the lake. And if someone doesn't fix this mess fast, all those poor fish will be belly up in minutes. Twisting my neck, I manage to look up the hill to see it's worse than I thought. All the students who came out to watch the frogs have gotten caught in the spell as well. Students cling to the grass, to bushes and posts, to each other. One girl is gripping a statue of Bach with one hand, while holding on to another girl with the other. That girl, in turn, is holding on to the feet of a screaming boy. All around them, frogs are spinning, floating, soaring. Even the rocks and twigs and other loose stuff on the ground is starting to drift away. Backpacks and instruments cases, loose papers and books and pens and someone's shoe. Then the branch Jai's holding onto snaps. He screams as he begins rising into the air with nothing to grab onto. "Jai!" I yell, and I let go, trying to swim through the air to him. We collide and go into a wild spin, frogs pinging off us. "That was bloody stupid," Jai shouts in my ear. "Now we're both dead." Immediately, I see he's right. The jumping after him was about the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. We hold hands to keep from being pulled apart, but that just means we're rising higher and higher together, borne on a spell that's showing no signs of weakening. And now, I don't want it to stop. If it does, we're going to have one nasty fall. Jai looks at me. I look at him. And together, we both start screaming. The kids on the ground get smaller and smaller. We're almost higher than Harmony Hall now. I scream until my throat burns and I choke on my own voice. We're not the only ones drifting up into the sky. I see other students, dozens of them, who lost their grips too, slowly tumbling through the air, screaming, crying. Except for one, who I recognize as the drummer from Rebel Clef. That maniac is laughing. Then Jai points frantically, so I look down and see the most amazing, wonderful, beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. Mrs. LaRue. She drifts out of Harmony Hall, carrying a cello, looking completely calm, like floating through a sky full of singing hum frogs with half the student body is just another day at the office. After she's a few feet off the ground, really, how does she manage to make even flying look so graceful? She props her cello on one foot, raises her bow, and then starts to play. "It's no use," I shout to Jai. "We already tried." "No, look," he replies. I gasp. "Of course." The hum frogs repeat the melodies they hear. And unlike me and Jai, Mrs. LaRue doesn't panic, even as frogs bounce off her. At first, Mrs. LaRue's music doesn't seem to make a difference. But then the frogs drifting right next to her start to change their tune. They sing her spell instead, and as they do, they start to descend. The spell spreads from there, as more and more frogs switch to the new spell. In minutes, the sky fills with the sound of Brahms's lullaby, and the frogs, fish, turtles, students, and other random objects all start drifting back to the ground. The animals return to the water as soon as they land, as if they can't wait to disappear into the murky depths and possibly never resurface. I wouldn't blame them. Once they vanish beneath the water, they fall silent. The spell Mrs. LaRue chose is gentle, and nobody goes crashing to their death. Instead, we touch down lightly, soft as feathers, amid the soothing notes. As soothing as 1,000 frogs can possibly sound, anyway. I'm not sure this is what Brahms had in mind when he wrote his famous lullaby, but at least it's working. I've never been so happy to feel solid ground. Dropping to my knees, I hug the grass. "Oh, Earth," Jai says beside me. "I'm never taking you for granted again." All around us, students cry out in relief as they're returned to the ground. Mrs. LaRue is the last one to touch down, settling onto the grass without missing a single note. She plays a few more measures, finishing the spell. Now all the frogs are silent, and the only sound is Mrs. LaRue's sonorous cello. The last note draws out, deep and melodious, and then it fades away. Everyone breaks into applause. Mrs. LaRue slowly lowers her bow, then raises furious eyes. The applause cuts short. Silence falls at last. Mrs. LaRue looks around, her lips tight. "I don't suppose anyone is going to take responsibility for this." No one speaks. She looks all around, studying every face. When her gaze finds me, I train my features to absolute stillness. But all my insides turn to water, and for a moment, I'm sure she's seen how guilty I am. But then she moves on. I let out a slow, relieved breath as everyone starts shuffling away. Jai and I turn to each other and exchange amazed looks, amazed that we somehow got away with this. Then a hand pounds my back, and I whirl with dread, thinking it's Mrs. LaRue. But it's Darby, her face flushed and eyes shining. "That went perfectly," she says. Jai looks like he's about to pop an eyeball. "Perfectly! Perfectly!" "You knew," I whisper, feeling sick. "You knew the frogs would repeat the spell, and that it would all get out of control." A little smile curls at the corner of her lips. "Look, Mrs. LaRue would never have come outside on account of a few floating frogs. A bunch of floating students, on the other hand." I gape at her. "Jai and I could have been killed." She shrugs. "But you weren't. Anyway, I bet you got a nice view of the campus. I'm almost jealous." I'm furious. I could happily watch her float into outer space right now. Was this some kind of revenge scheme? Her way of getting back at me for taking her Amelia's place? "How dare you, Jones," she says. "Look." She takes off her backpack, glancing around to be sure no one's watching, then unzips it slightly. 2 yellow eyes glow inside. Then a clawed paw darts out, nearly scratching my nose. I shout and step back as Darby quickly zips it shut. "Like I said," she smirks. "Perfectly." She carefully slings the backpack over her shoulder, then takes off in the direction of the girls' dorm, where she and I are supposed to meet Rosa for the trade, according to the note Darby found in our room this morning, slipped under the door in the night and signed unmistakably with a kiss of apple red lipstick. "She's nuts," I tell Jai. "She's completely, totally insane." He nods. "Yeah. But the view up there was pretty great." He yelps when I punch him in the shoulder. Chapter 20. The Sound of Music Cats. The next few days, all anyone can talk about is the Great Humfrog Float, which is what they're apparently calling it now. And soon, the story, much like the spell it started with, has gotten completely out of control.
"There's a rumor that a kid is missing,"
whispers George in the computer lab on Thursday. They say it's a 10th grader, floated right up into space. That's not true, I say. Oh, it's totally true, Jai puts in. I was there, saw the whole thing. See, what happened was... He launches into a long, complicated version of the story that is about 90% total lies. I just sigh and poke at the keyboard, working on yet another email to Gran that she won't reply to. I've tried to keep a low profile during these conversations, in case anyone starts to get suspicious about my involvement in the disaster. No one's been charged with the crime. Yet. But I swear I'm getting more and more sideways looks from the maestros. Jai says it's just my imagination, but I'm not so sure. Still, we got the black spell from Rosa, and that was the important thing. She even let Darby and me watch while she recorded Wink's humming spell, and let us set the music cat free outside when she was done. What the spell was for, I have no idea. And I'm not sure I want to know. Dear Gran, nothing new to report, except that I learned how to set a table using magic. No need to add that every dish I'd moved with my spell ended up shattering on the floor without ever actually touching the table, thanks to a ghostly arm knocking them out of the air. To everyone else, it had looked like I'd flubbed yet another lesson, and they just rolled their eyes and said, "Typical Amelia." Even Miss Nurani had just sighed and handed me a C-. How long will you stay mad at me? Are you never going to talk to me again? Biting my lip, I erase the last two lines and hit send, forgetting to add even my usual, "Love, Amelia." By Friday, the great Humfrog float story has died down, as everyone starts talking about musical zombies instead, which seems to be some kind of annual school-wide game played in the woods. "That's when you'll have to play the spell," Rosa had told Darby and me. "Rebel Clef will be playing during the game, and trust me, over the sound we'll make, nobody will notice." To hear some of them, you'd think it was the most important day of the year. Kids break off into groups to whisper strategies. The seniors scope out the woods where the game will be played. And on Friday night, the girls' dorm hums with activity late into the night, despite curfew. I can hear girls running back and forth from each other's rooms, shrieking and laughing. Since it's the weekend, and the dorm captains are as much into the pregame excitement as the rest of us, nobody says much about it. But Darby and I are too anxious to even think about the game. Or at least I'm anxious. I don't think anything could make Darby nervous, but she does sit on her bed for hours, studying the black spell and practicing the fingerings on her oboe. The spell is written for piano, and Darby has spent the last few days painstakingly rearranging it for a flute, oboe, and violin trio instead. "Strange," she mutters. "The spell is clearly rare and old. I've never heard of it. But it doesn't have the usual markings that tell you what class and type it is." "Why would it?" I ask. I've been trying to French braid my hair, the way Gran would do it for special occasions, but I keep ending up with a tangled mess. Finally, I just rake my brush through my hair and give up. If I were selling black spells, I wouldn't go around advertising what they were. "Yeah." She tugs thoughtfully at her lip, then pulls a pencil from behind her ear to make a small change to the arrangement. "It's weird. It's almost like ever since Darby and I saw the ghost in our room, we've been on the same team. Not really friends. Ever since she found out my secret, she's gone from being moody and withdrawn to outright mean, and even said she'd volunteer to be part of the orchestra that rips out my echo tree. But at least we're allies. We both need to talk to other Amelia, and we need each other to do it." "What will you say to her?" I ask softly. I'm not sure she's going to answer. She's quiet for a long time, staring hard at the sheets of music. But then she says, "I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. I just want to say something, anything. Goodbye, I guess. Tell her about my crappy roommate who took her place." I sigh. Apparently, she already knows all about me. Darby looks up then, her eyes hard. "Yeah, funny, isn't it? How she comes back from the grave to haunt you, but not to talk to me." "Huh?" I've got a pillow in my lap, and I hug it tighter. I mean, It is a total Amelia move, she adds. Revenge was always her thing, but she could have at least said hi to me, or not disappeared when I tried to talk to her. Like you said, she was probably just scared. And where has she been since then? She glares at me like it's my fault other Amelia is avoiding her. But what can I do? I'd be more than happy if the ghost shifted her attention to Darby. She struck 3 more times this week, blowing away my sheet music, moving my flute while I was playing it, even spilling my bowl of tomato soup at lunch. Everyone at the table had laughed so hard that Claudia choked on her bread and had to be given the Heimlich maneuver by Miss Becker. At least that distracted everyone from the fact that the ghost was busy dragging her invisible fingers through the spilled soup, spelling out a message just for me. Watch out. I dashed my hand through the soup before anyone could see, and before other Amelia could complete her threat. But I don't tell Darby about any of that. Even though, besides Jai, she's the only person who would believe me. The more I talk about other Amelia sabotaging me, the angrier Darby gets, and I need her as much on my side as possible. Because what if she decides to team up with other Amelia in getting me expelled? I can't last against both of them. We better get some sleep, Darby says at last, putting away the black spell. She keeps it hidden in a folder under her mattress. Tomorrow's the big day. I nod and slide under the blankets. In the hallway, a girl yells, "You are going down tomorrow, guppies! Get ready to be zombified!" I shiver and don't fall asleep for hours. Chapter 21. Catch Us If You Cannon. At dusk on Saturday, everyone gathers on the edge of the Echo Wood, dressed in dark clothing and toting their instruments. All except us guppies, who weren't allowed to bring anything. Musical Zombies is kind of like Capture the Flag, only instead of flags, you're supposed to capture 7th graders using charm spells. The students are divided into the 4 Mistwick classes: Arrows, Percussos, Cordos, and Librosos. Whichever of the 4 teams has the most of us guppies locked up in their camp at the end wins the game, and gets to claim the other class's desserts at every meal until Christmas.
You mean we don't even get to play? Jai groans. What's the point if you're just going to be bait?
Are you kidding? Says an 11th grader. The fact that we get to round up guppies is the best part. I wave to Jai as he's led away with the rest of the Cordos. I hope he doesn't get charmed, because I don't know if Darby and I can play the ghost trap spell on our own.
Got the sheet music? I whisper to her.
She nods and pats her pocket. Our instruments, wrapped in protective plastic bags, are hidden deeper in the wood, where we stashed them earlier in the day. We follow the senior arrows into the woods, walking in silent single file. It's dark under the trees, and the seniors shush anyone who tries to talk. They don't want to give away the location of our camp. Above, the branches of the echo trees look like bony fingers. Most of the leaves fallen by now. But even so, the sound of Cannon in D, the great summoning spell that protects the school, still echoes faintly in the branches. Then we hear a sudden roll of frantic drumbeats, and someone says, "It's Rebel Clef!" Rosa was right about her band. The minute they start playing, the whole Echo Wood fills with their music. The rock spell is dark and tense, the bass echoing in my bones, while the screeching guitar riffs wash over me like a swarm of spiders. Balls of fiery light drift through the trees, making the whole place a huge playground of shadows and light. The fireballs prowl around like they're looking for someone to devour, pulsing in time with the beat of the booming bass drum. Even though I know they're not real fire, just illusions, I still duck when one swoops overhead. Accompanied by the pounding tempo of Rebel Clef's spell, we reach Camp Arrow, a square clearing with torches burning at each corner and a sort of pen in the middle. That's where the older arrows will put the 7th graders they catch from Percusso, Cordo, and Librosso. Darby and I are branded with the other arrow guppies.
The eighth graders solemnly paint red stripes on our faces that indicate we're bait. I shiver, even dressed in my Mistwick sweatsuit and jacket. The sky is cloudy and the wind restless, like it's going to storm later. The echo trees shudder and creak overhead. The place might be peaceful and beautiful in the daylight, but at night, with Rebel Clef's fireballs stalking the woods, it's like a nightmare. Us guppies are all wide-eyed and scared, but the older students are obviously loving every minute. "Man, I'm glad I'm not in your shoes," says the eighth grader, painting my face. "Thanks," I mutter. "Listen up, guppies," yells Phoebe, our self-appointed arrow commander. She's got instruments hanging all over her. A piccolo in her hand, a flute case on her back, her belt holding a harmonica, a pan flute, and an ocarina. "Your job is simple. Run and don't get caught. And you're on your own out there. It's against the rules for us seniors to stay too close to you. So if you hear a charm spell, go in the opposite direction. If they get too close and you get charmed, you'll spend the rest of the night as a zombie. And you'll be in charge of washing our dirty gym clothes the rest of term." "This is a stupid game," Darby mutters. "But if, at the end of the night, you're still charm-free," Phoebe adds, "you'll get full honors. Access to the senior break room for the rest of the year." We all perk up at that. The senior break room is way better than ours. Rumor has it they have free arcade games and ping pong tables. Then I remember Darby and I have more important business. Off through the trees, the Rebel Clef drummer starts a long drum roll. "Almost time," Phoebe yells. "Loosen up, guppies!" Around me, the other seventh grade arrows start panicking. George looks like he's about to pass out. Claudia is pale and frozen in place. But Darby looks fierce and focused. She meets my eyes and gives me a small secret nod. I return it, my heart pounding as fast as the Rebel Clef drum. When the band launches into a loud, furious guitar solo, the older kids start shoving us toward the trees, screaming, "Run, run, run!" Darby finds me, grabs my hand, and pulls me into the woods. "We have to reach the rendezvous spot before any other teams find us," she says, "or we'll get charmed and lose our chance of pulling this off. And that chatty boyfriend of yours better not get himself caught." "He's not my..." But she's already sprinting away, and I have to race to catch up. We run through the woods, dodging the flaming balls and sticking to shadow, aiming for the place where Jai found me composing a few weeks ago, and where our instruments are hidden. He should be running from the Cordo camp now to meet us there. Suddenly I skid to a halt, grabbing Darby's hand. She pulls away. "What are you?"
"Shh! Listen."
I can hear a percusso playing a glockenspiel ahead, and I think they must be pretty committed to be this far out in the woods with such a big instrument.
"Charm spell,"
Darby whispers. I nod, and they're right between us and our instruments.
"Out of the way, guppies," calls a voice behind us.
We turn and nearly get bowled over by Phoebe, who's sprinting toward the hidden percusso. I wonder how she can run at all, carrying enough instruments to equip a small orchestra. She whips up her piccolo and blasts a freezing spell, blue light zinging from the opening of her instrument to speed through the trees, and we hear a startled shout ahead as the percusso spell cuts short. Phoebe lowers her piccolo and glares at us.
"Seriously, 2 minutes in and you're already almost getting caught."
"Jeez," Darby mutters, "it's only a game."
We dart past Phoebe as she splutters about how we're stupid kids who don't know the difference between a trumpet and a trombone. A short distance ahead, we pass the percusso, who's frozen in place by Phoebe's spell. She has a small glockenspiel in front of her, supported by a neck strap, but her fingers are locked on the keys, barely able to even twitch. Behind her is an unlucky Cordo seventh grader, his eyes wide and vacant in his trance state. I'll bet he was the first one caught tonight. He reminds me of Ruder when I charmed him out from under the coop.
"You won't get far,"
the percusso shouts at us, her voice strained as she struggles to move her frozen lips.
"This is our territory."
These guys take this way too seriously, Darby says. Maybe it's more fun when you're not the bait, I reply. She laughs, and I think that's the first time I've ever heard her do that. We charge on through the trees, stopping every now and then to get our bearings. Wherever we go, we can hear Rebel Clef's music like a distant heartbeat, pumping through the echo wood. The trees faintly resonate along, but this far out from the band, the spell sounds slightly warped. And there's a funny tune mixed in, a high, eerie tone. Darby and I slow to a stop. An angel steps out from behind a tree ahead of us, playing a deep, haunting melody on her viola. Her long, dark hair shimmers around her shoulders. Her spell floats around her, airy, white curls of magic that make her shine. The melody is entrancing, velvet notes pouring into my mind and filling it with soft, warm light, light that obliterates all thought. A feeling of peace suffuses me, and I feel all my muscles relax. My worries release, carried away by that smooth current of magic. The violist's dark eyes seem to glow as she approaches us. Closer and closer she gets, until she's standing between us, smiling over her viola. Darby stares too, eyes wide, mouth open. When the Cordo girl walks on, Darby and I follow. Slowly, she leads us through the trees, her spell unending, her magic delicate and bright. White, wispy lights caress my face and wind in my hair, drawing me along. My head is full of pleasant, fuzzy warmth, and all I want is to keep feeling the way I'm feeling right now, forever. I've never been so free of pain and struggle and worry. Dimly, I remember that I was supposed to be going somewhere, to do something important, but I can't recall what it was. And now it seems so small and silly. Someone ahead of us shouts, a boy waving us over. He seems happy to see us. I don't really care.
In here, says the boy. Hurry, hurry! That's two at once, Rhea. Amazing!
The girl leads us into a fenced area surrounded by torches. In the firelight, she's even more beautiful. I want to lie at her feet and profess my undying loyalty. Then she lowers her viola, and the spell breaks. Ugh, she moans. My fingers feel raw. Darby and I blink at each other blearily. My head clears as the last of the charm fades away, and a feeling of horror sweeps over me as I realize the position we're now in.
No,
Darby groans, rubbing her head. This can't be happening.
Oh, it's happening, says the Cordo girl cheerfully. You two were easy pickings.
My turn, says the boy.
He looks at his teammate.
Watch these two while I go hunt.
She nods and perches on the fence. The boy closes the gate and heads into the woods, lifting a guitar and starting to strum the most beautiful tune.
Snap out of it, Jones, Darby yells.
I blink, startled, and then clap my hands over my ears. Is this how Ruder felt every time I charmed her out from under a coop or down from the branches of a tree? Like her mind had been stolen and played with like putty in someone else's hands? I've got a lot of apologizing to do to that chicken. The Cordo girl, Rhea, laughs.
You might as well get comfortable. It's going to be a long night.
Miserably, I sit in the corner. Darby paces in front of me, looking furious. We could sneak out, I whisper. She shakes her head.
She'll just charm us before we can go three steps.
Groaning, I lie back on the loamy forest floor and stare up as a Rebel Clef fireball passes overhead. Is it my imagination? Or does that thing have a face? It looks like a fiery, grinning skull. I wouldn't put it past Rosa, going the extra mile to scare us all. The fireball passes over and straight through a tree outside the fence. I glance at Rhea, just to see if she might be looking the other way so we can sneak off, but she's looking right at me. She smiles and blows me a kiss. And I sit up straight, stomach turning over. Rhea! Rhea, behind you! But Rhea only rolls her eyes.
Nice try, Guppy.
No, really, the tree. The tree is on fire.
Darby looks up and gasps. I'd thought the fireballs were just illusions, but where it hit the tree, flames are now spreading. The leaves are going up in smoke, and burning branches crash to the ground. Rhea must sense the light because she finally turns and then falls off the fence with a yelp. Fire! She screams. Fire! She turns and runs in the other direction as the fire jumps from one tree to the next, forming a massive curtain of flames. I stare at it, taking one step forward and sniffing the air. Huh. Vanilla.
Are you crazy? Darby yells. Come on, it'll be here in seconds.
She pulls on my sleeves, but I push her away and grin. This way. While she gapes, I run toward the fire and straight through it. It's an illusion, I shout. It's just like the fire from the planting ceremony, which everyone had thought was real. There's no heat coming from these flames at all. I see Darby hesitate on the other side of the fire, but then she must make up her mind because she sprints toward me. Even so, she gives a little shriek when she passes through the flames. Told you, I say. Listen. Someone is playing a violin ahead, and I have a good idea who it is. Jai, I shout when he walks out of the trees. He grins as he wraps up the spell, then takes a low bow. Behind us, his fire flickers out, and the trees, which had looked charred and smoldering, are back to their normal state.
I got to the meeting spot, and you guys weren't there, he says. Figured you got yourself zombified, so you're welcome.
Darby grunts. I think she's embarrassed, since she'd been so sure he would be the one to get charmed. Come on, she says. We've lost too much time already. I high-five Jai as we follow her into the trees. That was amazing. You should have seen that girl take off. He shudders.
This game sucks. Those seniors are maniacs. We're going to need therapy after.
Let's go, Darby growls.
Chapter 22. The Cords of Binding. After retrieving my flute and Darby's oboe, we head deeper into the woods, trying to get as far from the other students as we can. Pinning my case under my arm, I rub my hands together, trying to warm them. The night's getting colder and colder. My breath starts appearing as a misty puff in front of me. We walk until we can't see any light from the fireballs or hear Rebel Clef's spells. This deep into the woods, many of the trees aren't even echo trees, just regular aspens and pines. We must be at the very edge of the school property. Beyond, the mountains rise up and block out the sky. Okay, I say, after 10 minutes of hiking. Think this will do it? Darby drops her case and clicks it open, taking out her oboe. We'll need light to read the spell. On it, says Jai, striking a quick rendition of This Little Light of Mine. A soft blue ball of light flickers into existence over our heads. It's just enough to illuminate the spell sheets Darby made for us, transposed from the original spell. This isn't too hard, Jai says, eyeing the pages as he lowers his violin. The blue light flickers, and we don't have much time before it fades altogether.
I'll take the melody, Darby says. Jai, you pick up here, and Amelia can come in here.
She points at different sections on the sheet, the notes all precisely drawn in her neat hand. Ready? I say, looking at each of their faces. Their features seem to jump in the flickering blue light, looking eerie with the paint striped across them, red for Darby and blue for Jai. They both nod.
Wait a sec, Jones, says Darby. We need to settle something. If this works, I get to talk to her first.
Fine. But remember, you agreed to ask her to leave me alone. She shrugs, looking aside. Darby, that was the deal.
Yeah, whatever, she says, scowling. I remember.
Hurry up, Jai urges. This place is giving my goosebumps, goosebumps. Darby rolls her eyes and puts her oboe to her lips.
Ready? She says around the reed.
Jai and I both nod. The spell is called Dies Irae. I've never heard of it before, and neither have the other two, which makes sense since it's a black spell. All we have to go on that it'll work is Rosa's word. But just as I put my flute to my lips, a voice in the back of my head wonders if she can be trusted. But it's too late to chicken out now. The melody is stately and grand, a solemn procession of notes. It reminds me of the old cathedrals I saw in London when we picked up Jai on the Zeppelin, somber and ancient and regal. We play at an even tempo, thankfully, since I don't think my cold fingers could manage anything faster. It's a fairly simple tune, though I notice Darby gave me the easiest arrangement, while she and Jai thread in more complicated bits. The sound of our three instruments blends together, and soon, streamers of light flow from each of us to twine in the air, a slowly revolving knot of light. We all stare, and I see the other two are as confused as I am. "Yellow," Jai says. Since Darby and I can't talk and play at the same time, we just shrug. Maybe that's how black spells are. It's not like we've ever seen one before. But Darby's face is hard, her eyes suspicious. I wonder if she thinks this was all a dupe. Still, I've never seen a spell work like this before. The streamers whirl overhead and grow until we stand beneath a spinning ring of golden light. It bounces off the trees around us, a bright yellow lasso tethered to our three instruments. I can't look long because I'm struggling to follow the notes on the spell sheet lying between us. A minute later, we finish the spell. The last notes fade into the trees, and the yellow magic dissipates. "Did it work?" whispers Jai. We stand very still, listening. The trees sway slightly. Crickets chirp from the leaves. Overhead, the sky rumbles in the distance, warning of a storm on its way. My breath fogs the air and then fades. I peer into the dark forest, turning a full circle to check every direction. Jai and Darby do the same. Then we all look at each other. "Maybe I arranged it wrong," Darby says. "And the more you rearrange a melody, the weaker it gets." Jai rolls his eyes. "Or maybe there's just no such thing as go." He cuts off in a scream as a shadow grabs his ankle and he slams into the ground. "Jai," I shout. "What?" Something grabs me by the waist. Then it drags me backwards, like an arm around my middle, and I yelp and drop my flute onto the leaves. The thing holding me tightens until I can barely breathe. Loud creaks and rustles sound all around. It's like the whole forest has come alive. I scream until I can't breathe. In front of me, Darby yells as something seizes her, too. In the pale glow of Jai's spell light, I see what grabbed us. It's the trees. With a gasp, I find myself pinned against the trunk of a tall aspen that's holding me in place with two strong branches. Jai is locked against a pine, and Darby is in the clutches of another. Its needles block her face until she reaches up and rips them away. "What happened?" she groans. We look around at each other, bewildered. There's no sign of the ghost of other Amelia. Our instruments are scattered on the ground. My heart misses a beat, hoping my flute's okay. "Rosa," I croak out. "She tricked us." "It was a trapping spell, all right," says Jai. "But not for a ghost. For us." "Why? Why would she do that?" Darby growls. "She was just using us to get the musicat." "We are so dead," moans Jai. "Let's just use our heads," I say, trying to keep calm. "It's not like we'll be stuck here forever. Someone will come looking." I try furiously to think of a way out of this, but even if I could reach my flute, I can't think of any spell that will free us from the trees, not without possibly hurting ourselves in the process. I hear a sniffle and realize Darby is crying a little. She came here thinking she'd talk to her dead friend, but instead it was all a trick. I know how much she wanted this, how badly she needed to see the other Amelia. What if I'd been given the chance to see my mom again, only to have it ripped away? "We'll get out of this," I say, "and then we'll find Rosa and get the real spell." "Don't talk to me about what's real," she snarls. I stare at her. "Darby, no, don't. She's a fake, Jai," she spits out. "She's not even supposed to be here." I just stare at her, my heart sinking.
She's only here by accident, Darby says. She's not good enough for Mistwick and never will be. She failed her audition, so she stole my Amelia's place. While the rest of us worked our butts off, practicing for years and years to get here, sacrificing everything to come, she tricked and lied her way in.
I didn't, I shout. It was an accident, a mix-up.
You're not good enough for Mistwick. You don't belong here. You never did. You're just a big, awful joke.
Jai looks at me, his eyes round, and my heart sinks. He stares like he's seeing me for the first time, and I just know he's going to be mad at me for never telling him the truth. Maybe even mad enough that he'll never talk to me again. After all, why would he want to be known as the kid who hangs out with the school joke? But then he turns back to Darby.
So? Who cares? She's here now, and she's one of us. I don't care if she turns out to be a google-eyed, tentacle-waving slime alien from Neptune. She's still my friend.
My heart lifts. I give him a small, grateful smile and wonder how I could ever have doubted him. I was so ashamed of admitting the truth, I couldn't see what a good friend he really is. Just for the record, I say, I am from planet Earth.
Darby glares at me in the fading light of Jai's spell. The real Amelia was a great musician and my friend. She was 100 times better than you'll ever be.
I want to shout back, to tell her it's not true. But I realize she's right. I've seen the videos of other Amelia, and she is 100 times better than me. I am just an accident. Even the one thing that could make me special, my composing, only happens when I'm not trying to make it happen. Another accident. Overhead, the sky rumbles with thunder, and lightning flashes in the distance, veins of white behind a bank of dark clouds. I shiver as the wind picks up. The trees sway around, sounding like bones clacking together. Please, please don't let it rain, I think, staring mournfully at my flute, exposed on the ground. The temperature drops until my teeth start to chatter. I buck and twist, but nothing will free me from the tree's grasp. Giving up, I slump forward. It's hard to breathe with the tree squeezing my lungs. I sag over the branch, hopeless. At least it's still dry. Then Jai screams. I look up at once and spot her, in the trees, barely visible in the gloom. A ghostly blue girl, half transparent in the darkness. The three of us gape as she watches us, almost as if she's curious why we're stuck out here in the middle of a storm.
Amelia, Darby shouts. Amelia, it's me.
The girl looks at her, but it's hard to read her expression when I can barely even make out her face. Did the spell work after all? But then the ghost turns and glides away and soon vanishes. Then Jai's light winks out and we're plunged into darkness. Jai and Darby say nothing. When lightning flashes again, I catch a glimpse of my roommate crying and Jai looking totally spooked. He's actually speechless for once. His eyes meet mine, and I realize this might be the first time he's actually believed the ghost existed. Other Amelia doesn't appear again.
That was a ghost, Jai gasps. A ghost!
Yes, I sigh. We know. His eyes are practically falling out of his head.
But did you see it? She was there. Then she wasn't. There, not there. There, not there. Why are you guys not freaking out right now?
Shut up, Jai, Darby says.
This is not normal. This is not how the world works. Ghosts are supposed to be like zombies and the Necromuse and an A in history of musicraft. Not real.
Darby scowls.
Keep blabbering and I'll get that hippo spell from Rosa and make sure you both spend the rest of the year flopping around in the lake.
He moans and pulls his head down like a turtle trying to hide in its shell. As I shiver against the tree, partly from the cold, partly from my own raw nerves, I wonder if musical zombies got canceled because of the lightning. If so, will they realize three kids are still missing? Will they even bother looking in this weather? The lightning storm seems to last for hours. My body aches from being pinned so long. And Darby's words keep pounding in my head.
You're only here by accident. I'm not good enough. I'll never be good enough. My name is Amelia Jones, I think. I work hard and I don't give up easily. My mom was a maestro, and if I just try hard enough, if I just want it badly enough, I can be one too. This is where I'm supposed to be. This is what I was born to do.